Okay, this is not a question, just a nice observation. Dear Rajan, you and your crew have been and continue to be so generous with us. This abundant generosity is such an incredible teaching. It seems as though it's the stuff that may save the planet. Blessings. Which is, that's that quality of generosity. You know, for us as monastics, then it's like I've mentioned a couple of times, you know, without the generosity of many, many people, then we don't get to eat, we don't have clothes, we don't have a place to stay. So that it's the generosity that supports us and the Sangha and the teachings. But then it's, you know, when you receive that, then you want to give that as well. And of course, that's actually how the Buddha structured it, because we don't actually have material things to give anybody, but we can give teachings, we can give example, we can give encouragement to people to practice the Dhamma and to hopefully experience the fruits of the Dhamma. And that, that generosity is kind of a glue that holds everything together, and that, it's a beautiful quality. Also, for many of us, probably the only one, Chunda, who probably hasn't spent time in Thailand as a monastic or a practitioner. So that, but you know, all the rest of us have been in Thailand, and that's one of the kind of striking qualities of the culture is generosity. It's the favorite. Like, there's folk kind of plays, music, there's a whole festival day that's sort of like the favorite time of year, and it's the reenactment of the Jataka story, the previous birth story of the Buddha in his last birth before being Siddhartha Gautama, and that's when he perfects the virtue, the barmy of generosity, and so it's in from the time kids, you know, when you're little kids and you grow up, or you just so that popular sense of the goodness of it, and then also just children see generosity from the time they're very young, just by having monastics wandering through their villages or town or city, and because it's usually families will come out, or people will bring the children along, and they'll participate in making offerings, putting things into bowls, and even if they're just little kids or even still babies, and you'll get them to put something in their hand, and then you go, okay, put it in the bowl, okay, drop that, and then, and the mothers, uncles, and aunts, and, oh, very good, gang, and this, and the little baby says, oh, that must have been good, oh, yeah, okay. So it just sort of seeps in, and the generosity is something that's quite tangible that, we've received, and recognizing that it is a glue that holds a community together, a society together. Dear Ajahn, as followers of the Buddha, and with the world going to the hell realms in a handbasket, must we save the world? May we use our lives to develop wisdom and compassion and see what action flows from there. Right? That developing wisdom and compassion would save the world. the more people that are willing to do that, that cultivation of all these wholesome qualities, from generosity to virtue to wisdom to compassion, these are the things that would provide a basis for really lasting change. Ajahn, thank you for your patience in answering question after question. I am wondering about how to address social anxiety. For me, it seems important in terms of continuity of practice. However, I've never heard any teachings about it. Did the Buddha ever teach talking meditation or some equivalent? Well, that's actually, you know, forms a part of the in the discourse on the foundations of mindfulness. It forms a part of the clear comprehension and carrying that clear comprehension into the things we do, the engagement that we have. The Buddha also, in terms of, I think like the effect, and the Buddha states this, is that they say the effect of being grounded in virtue and the precept, and particularly around speech, when one is devoted to true speech, harmonious speech, supportive speech, not frivolous talk, then the effect is of that kind of a virtue and being grounded in skillful communication. There's a sense of confidence that one has in going into a social situation, and it isn't contrived and it can't be sort of forced, but it has its effect in that, there is a sense of, as one gains more clarity and confidence in just fundamental goodness, and then the kind of trust that's engendered by having that clarity of conduct and speech, does allay much of the anxiety of having to deal with people. For myself, one of the things that I used over and over is returning to the body. Of course, people can hear that over and over again because I found it so useful. By coming back to the body, then finding a place of recognition where there's anxiety or fear or discomfort, and then being able to relax with that discomfort or anxiety, and just constantly returning to the body and then releasing and settling and allowing an ease to come into the body. And of course that has its effect on the mind. The mind becomes, isn't sort of shrinking in or holding tightly to those feelings of anxiety, or you know, just kind of apprehension in having to deal with people. I remember the first time I went back to Canada after having been a monk in Thailand for 16 years. I hadn't been back, and I was invited to give a talk in the city of Winnipeg, which is sort of, I grew up about 500 miles north of there in a small town, but that was, I had many relatives there, and I went to university there, so I knew people, and then when they heard I was coming, and there was interest, a Buddhist group there, so they invited me to give a talk. And a couple of the people who were there were, one in particular who made the comment was actually Dale, him and his wife were just at the monastery recently. And then, so I gave a talk. I'm up in front of a group of people and giving a talk, and as I do. And he said, I can see this has really made a change in you, because I would have never believed that you'd get up in front of a group of people and talk. Because of social anxiety, fear, shyness, self-consciousness, that played a huge role in how I perceive myself and the world around me. So that just coming back to mindfulness of the body, virtue, all of those things they melt those unnecessary tendencies that we oftentimes carry around. Ajahn, thank you. I'd appreciate your speaking about the place of renunciation in lay life, especially marriage and family. As the years of life and practice go by, I feel less and less interest and connection with so much of our society and what it offers. Unfortunately, I also get attracted to my views, and so judgments of others who don't see it this way. My wife and family know this about me, and fortunately, we still love and tolerate and enjoy each other. There's always, you know, in renunciation is the opportunity to let go of those things that create suffering, and that opportunity to let things go, or to not be drawn into them. That being said, there's still the realm of responsibility and duty. And so that even in a monastery where the level of renunciation is quite high, there's still responsibility and duty and obligations to each other within the community, obligations to the lay community, and those kind of interactions. So it's really trying to pinpoint within the circumstances of one's life where one can let go, relinquish, incline to renunciation, so that the life and the mind don't get too complicated and messy. But also being attuned to the people that we have responsibility towards, and not just shutting it out. Um, There's a, you know, because it's not just all about letting go, it's learning how to do things in a balanced way also. There's a story from Ajahn Chah that in the early years of establishing his monastery at Wat Bapong, there was one rainy season where he was just walking around checking out the dwelling places and checking out the place and, you know, what it, and then he comes across one of the kutti, it's one of the dwelling places, and, you know, they're quite small and really just, you know, pretty basic. And especially in the early days, it really was basic. You know, had a thatch roof, but about a third of the thatch had been blown off. There was this great gaping hole in the roof. And Ajahn Chah waited till the evening meeting and said, you know, I was walking around the monastery today, and I wonder who lives in such and such a dwelling place. And Burma said, no, it's me. And he said, have you noticed that there's a hole in your roof? He said, oh yes, there was a storm a few days ago, and it blew the many of the thatching off. He said, well, why haven't you fixed it? And he said, well, I'm trying to follow your teachings. And he said, well, what teachings is that? Well, you keep teaching us to let go. And so that necessitated a long talk on what you actually let go of and what you actually do. And so that taking on of, there's a whole realm of responsibilities and duties and relationships that we have that have to be grounded in Dhamma. And if one has marriage and family, then one has responsibilities, and one has they're appropriate to be attending to with the foundation of Dhamma. Otherwise, it gets complicated and messy. Dukkha. Regarding the four responsibilities, two aspects. One are the three kinds of dukkha, the dukkha, sankhara dukkha, and the viparinama dukkha, the dukkha of just dukkha itself, the dukkha of things being of a compounded nature, and then the dukkha of separation. Are the three kinds of dukkha equivalent to fully understanding dukkha, anatta, and anicca, anicca being impermanence? And two, is full understanding the First Noble Truth equivalent to full realization of the third? I'm unclear, because nibbana equals ceasing anicca and anatta. When one understands all the nuances of dukkha, then that is, because all you need to do is see one thing. If you really understand dukkha, then anatta and anicca are apparent. Or if you understand anicca fully, then you'll get dukkha and anatta bit. And the same with the other. So it's like it's a window for experiencing those characteristics of existence more fully and clearly. Full understanding of the First Noble Truth is certainly almost always the basis or the foundation a full realization of the third, that being the cessation of dukkha. That has to be qualified a little bit because that full understanding is really a penetrative knowledge that is needed rather than being immersed in dukkha and feeling one, oh, I get it, there's a lot of dukkha, but it's like a real penetrative knowledge and understanding. But the reality is also is that the Nibbana doesn't actually make impermanence cease, or even anatta, because those are just fundamental nature of things, and dukkha ceases in terms of an inner experience of dissatisfaction or dukkha in some way. And the actual reality of dukkha being a characteristic of existence is still present, but it's not creating a problem. Ajahn, teachings on metta have led me to wonder about the second kind of love. Seems that holding people dear to us, especially family, is very natural. The inevitable loss also seems natural, a loss we all learn from. How to think about this? It's just sort of seeing, we obviously, family and with close friendship that we hold those people more closely. There's a warmth and it's quite natural. I mean, but then it also has to be reflected on and understood that. There's inevitable separation. There's inevitable change, and it isn't just sort of putting that stiff upper lip and steeling oneself against any kind of loss, but it's sort of like, oh, this is the way things really are. And really taking that in, so that there's a clear understanding and an acceptance of that truth, and then not being shaken, and that in itself actually opens up a lot of. Well, that's a lot of compassion and caring because you really recognize that as human beings, I mean, there's just all these different ways that we create complication and suffering, and just how to avoid that, and then also how to try to be a force of caring and support for, say, our fellow human beings, and particularly those who are close to us. You've had such good answers to all questions. I thought I'd try the one I've been asking forever. What is the meaning of life? It just means we get old and sick and die. Not to make a problem out of it. Ajahn Kurundamo, thank you for the 32 parts meditation. It's part of my practice, so that reinforced it. Yeah, and it's say everybody's good fortune to. That's one of the. It's kind of the. This being billed as a monastic retreat, then you get some of the flavor of the monastic inclinations and tools that we use, and there's a lot of tools. So that contemplations of the body are very helpful adjunct for in our practice. It would be nice to chant the fusion with divine abidings. There's our chanting leader. He's got the message. What is a good way to cultivate forgiveness and compassion deeper in the heart? What are genuine signs of progress? The basis of compassion is the recognition of suffering. So it's not the sort of trying to conform to some ideal of what compassion should be, but it's the opening the heart to suffering, and then the response that comes from a desire to alleviate both one's own suffering and the suffering of others. And so the more clearly we look into our own hearts and see how suffering arises, how it lingers, its different nuances and all the different causes, then we start to of course we want to respond, and the response is compassion in terms of wanting to allay the suffering of ourselves and others. And part of the act of forgiveness is a tool for letting go of suffering, so that sense of coming back to seeing that, say, as human beings, back to that idiom, bound by ignorance and obstructed by craving, that's how your ordinary, unenlightened, uninstructed worldling lives in the world. And to recognize that most people just aren't aware of the suffering they're creating, and then to be willing to offer forgiveness and to use forgiveness as a tool, because one sees it comes out of suffering. People do things, and whether they recognize it or not, or whether they see it at all, it comes out of a place of suffering, and it's worthy of compassion and forgiveness. And the genuine signs of progress are sort of our own decrease in suffering. Because that's one of the what do they call it? It's called the near enemy of compassion is pity, like to pity somebody. And it's a near enemy in the sense that it's close, but no cigar. Yes. That sense that it's sort of like compassion, but there's suffering there. That pitying somebody, feeling sorry for somebody, feeling moved by, in a sense of taking on the suffering of others, which actually is what compassion means in English. So the taking on the suffering of others, but from the, say, the Buddhist perspective, the response is an alleviation of suffering and a releasing of suffering. By chanting the supreme praise of the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, we bow and ask for forgiveness and set a new intention. Although I don't know any specific offense, is this general, just in case, asking for forgiveness? What if there are any specific offenses? Is it enough to hold them in my awareness? Yeah, I mean, it's just, yeah, it's that again, setting a kind of a mood, a flavor in the mind of, because that asking, that sort of asking of forgiveness is a way of, say, articulating humility and setting aside our own personality, preferences, ideas, and then just putting it all down and then, yeah, setting a new intention, opening to something that is based in refuges of awakening, of truth, of virtue. Those are, that's and it doesn't have to be a specific offense or something. It's just a, you know, one start learning how to try to cultivate that quality of humility and openness to changing ourselves and growing, and then, you know, even if there is, then it's just holding it in awareness is all we really need to do. It's just so it becomes clear and it can be relinquished and released. Can you say more about the teaching? It's unfair that Debbie spoke about, given by Ajahn Sumedho. Thank you. Yeah, well, that's the feeling of, you know, being a human being in samsara, in this, in the world of born. What do they say? Hey, born for what? Born for getting old, aging, dying. Well, that's unfair. You know, where we, you know, we experience the change and uncertainty of the conditions of the world, and it shouldn't be that way. It's unfair. Damn it. Yeah. And we experience our own inability to be disciplined or live up to our own ideals. That's unfair. You know, so there's all of these things it shouldn't be that way. And of course it is. And then how do we hold it? How do we deal with it? How do we skillfully bring it back in for our own contemplation and aspiration and bringing forth a skillful motivation towards the Dhamma. There's a Hershey's Kiss. Now, John, the only way we'll ever probably be able to give you a kiss. it's very sweet. Would you please share on the meaning of practicing with integrity? So that's in that chant on the recollection of the Sangha, and the word in Pali is samichit patipanno, so practicing, and it's practicing with integrity. But that samichi is like, say, what's appropriate, or what's really truly skillful, what is kind of right. And so that sense of understanding what is really true and right, and then being able to put it into our actions, so that there's an integrity that one is adhering to Dhamma, adhering to the principles of the Dhamma, and walk in the talk, being able to live it, to be it, so that's a manifestation of that practicing with integrity, doing, really knowing how to do the right thing at the right time in terms of what's skillful, what's wholesome, what's true, and what brings truth back into the world. Thank you, Debbie, for your Dhamma. Metta. You can't believe this, what I have to go through to get her here. She needs to hear that. In one meditation, I had the sure knowledge for a few moments that experience, all the versions of me throughout life until the present, were and are fabrication, that there is no time but the present, and nothing but the experience through the six senses and what the mind makes of it. Then a big wave of fear came into the mind. I'm going nuts, coming unglued, unhinged, unmoored. I swam back to safety. Was I going nuts? Or if this was experiential insight, why so scary? What allows insight to be stabilized and integrated? Thank you for your teachings and kind presence. That's a genuine insight, and then it's a very normal response. because what happens is the sense of self, I, me, is sort of in the background, in abeyance. One gets a glimpse of the way things really are. Then impermanence sets in, and it's an impermanent experience. The self, the sense of self, comes up, and it's sort of like, holy crap! I can't take this in. I don't believe. And because what it means is, this sense of me and our idea of who we think we are in the world. It isn't the way we thought it was, and that's great, but it is scary. but it's also it's that to be able to gain the confidence to challenge that sense of self, the sense of I, the habit of me. And that's of course why all of the say like that it, that that you don't just teach insight practice, you teach generosity, you teach patience, you teach kindness, you teach compassion, you teach virtue, you teach integrity, you teach calm abiding, and teach this a firm establishing of the mind, And that gives the ground for one to take in the fact that, wow, yeah, everything I ever conceived of or thought of or believed in, it's really not that way at all. And it's okay. In fact, it's way more than okay. But and again, it's sort of it's that sense of self kicks in, and it shakes the foundation of our habitual assumptions of me and the world, and that can be scary. That's also why practicing with good spiritual friends, good spiritual friendship, kalyanamitta. You have that web of support and encouragement, and then also, you know, because the mind sort of says, yeah, I must be coming unhinged, and everything is not good. And then remember the habit would be just go back to a sense of security and safety and familiarity with whatever one's old habits are, so that one's it's not so scary, not so intimidating, and of course it's not much of an option, but it's what we want to do. So that's where having that support of good kalyanamitta and have good teachers. And that's the Buddha himself said, he's the speaking of himself, I'm a kalyanamitta to the world. So he's a good spiritual friend. And of course that's where the Buddha keeps pointing us, to look at anicca dukkha anatta and seeing, and the implications when you first start, yeah, it's sort of like this, and but then you, as you really internalize it, and the implications are, wow, everything really is impermanent, and it is unsatisfactory, and it is not self. Now what do I do? So the ground of all the other sort of barami and wholesome qualities and skillful qualities that we cultivate, those are the things that bring that sense of confidence and clarity of, yeah, this is the way forward. Okay, would you contrast the samatha transformation of the five hindrances with the vipassana approach of uprooting them? And is there an integration of the two? I mean, they really have to work together in the sense that, in terms of a samatha practice, and you're trying to bring them into abeyance, settling them down. But that in itself is you're gaining a familiarity with how they work. You can't really bring them to tranquility without seeing them clearly and being able to let them go to a certain degree. The insight practice of really learning how to undermine and relinquish them completely, those are, one is it takes time, and say like skeptical doubt as a hindrance is completely relinquished with stream entry. The hindrance of sense desire and ill will would be completely relinquished with anagami or non-returning. And the hindrance of restlessness, and although it's probably pretty subtle by then, but still there's a rest that isn't really completely relinquished until arahantship, kind of looking for something else. So these are the hindrances are. You use them in helping to foster concentration and peaceful states of mind. But the more you investigate them and see them more clearly and work on the undermining, uprooting of them, then it forms an integrated part of the insight practice. But as I said, the full relinquishment of them, it's down the road a bit. Okay. In one discourse, I think to the young Sigala, the Buddha advises against singing, dancing, and attending fairs. But fairs are fun. And song, dance can inspire. Please comment. Fearless affairs. Fairs are fun. Us Buddhists don't like fun. Killjoys. but it's, I think one of the things that it's, it's also associations when you're in a public fair, where there is all this activity going on, it's just not very settling, it's not very peaceful. And almost invariably, there's probably intoxicants happening, and when you're in association even if you're not sort of engaging oneself, just having to be around people who aren't restrained in that way. It's agitating to the mind. It's not settling, and then I think what pops up in my mind is at the village. That's the sort of the main village of support for the international monastery. There was. Over the period of time that I was the abbot, and maybe even before then, there was in that period of time, there was two or three village boys, young men, who were stabbed and killed in fights. And it was at the village fair. It's just what happens. And it's just, that's why it's helpful to, as part of it, in that sense. It's not always what people are seeking, what they consider fun in all sorts of different ways. Certainly there's a very skillful use in particular of music and song, throughout all cultures, really. But in So I'm mainly familiar with Thailand as a culture, so that there's many of the so the folk music and festivals would be around music that Buddhist teachings would be woven through. It was entertaining. It was inspiring. It was uplifting, and that's a traditional use of song and music. It definitely has a role. But again, sometimes it's not so settling. So that it depends where you are, what you're looking for, what's resonating. I know, Reverend Hung Shur, who some of you probably know, he's a Berkeley Buddhist Monastery American disciple of Reverend Master Xuan Hua, and he was a musician as a lay person, and he was very talented. And then when he went to the monastery, and after some time getting serious about ordination, and he wanted to give up all his musical instruments, because in monastic rule, monks aren't allowed to play music or touch musical instruments even. So he said, I gotta give it up. I'm so defiled. Let's push away. And he went to Master Hua and sort of expressed that, and I need to give that adjunct. And Reverend Master Xuan Hua said, well, wait a minute, just let it be for a while. And he said, no, I got to give it up. And I said, I'm going to give them all away. I'm gonna say. And Master Hua shook his head and said, stupid. And then he lived as a training and practicing, and I think it was about he'd been a monk for about, I think it was probably over 25 years or so already, and he hadn't touched a musical instrument, and then it was actually at one of the groups at Berkeley Buddhist Monastery that was James Perez, his group, and James, it was James's 50th birthday, for that evening, then James played a song on his guitar, and which I don't think forms an integral part of his regular sort of teaching venue, but it was sort of, that was a special night. And one of the things that Hung Shur was there, and what he noticed was, it was a big group, it was kind of boisterous. As soon as that music started, everybody settled down and focused. So he said, maybe this could be useful. So then he started experimenting with, and of course he's been writing songs, and they're all dumb songs, and he's very talented. He's very good. So it can be used in a skillful way. But he said, Hung Shur said, you have to be really careful, because it's so easy for the sense of self to come in. He said, because he did a recording, and normally he was quite quite, you know, he's quite aware, and he sets a very strong intention, and then went to record. They had time at the recording studio, and then the sort of the backup musicians were there, and then all of a sudden, all this old memory and habit sort of came out, and then most of the session was very good, but then there were some on listening to it after, and it's not acceptable. There's just the use of the voice and inflection, it's sort of, you know, reaching out and trying to hook. And he said, if it comes from that, that's not Dhamma. That's not useful. And of course, that's much of what music is, you know, reaching out and hooking as best one can. But, you know, so there's skillful ways and there's parameters. And so but it's a very interesting reflection on use of skillful means. Witnessing the cessation after the exhalation benefited this morning's meditation a lot. Thank you for the wonderful tool. Yeah, I've found it helpful over the years. And just that very, very simple thing that's happening all the time. Yeah, so to really be present with it. Janpasano, thank you for your patience and assistance to fearlessly enter the dark and untamed forests of our minds. What or how would you suggest in terms of habits and practices that we may skillfully observe and or interact with the sleeping mind? There's actually many, many things to do, because that's... a lot of it is setting intention before one goes to sleep. And mindfully paying attention to the breath and just letting that mindfulness be the thing that one falls asleep with. Ajahn, one of the questions that Ajahn Chah would sometimes ask us as meditators, practitioners, sort of, when you fell asleep last night, did you fall asleep on the in-breath or the out-breath? You know, or when you woke up, did you wake up on the in-breath or the out-breath? That's a result of that mindfulness that we bring into the things we're doing. And then also bringing that into sleep. Because usually, you know, there's that kind of... especially as meditators, where you're practicing and trying, it's like, oh, wow, break! Now I just fall asleep and drift into annihilation. Isn't that great? Can put it down for a while, but as we continue to practice, and you start to really cherish the mindfulness, and so that you start carrying it into sleep as well, and you find that sleep is a kind of awareness that underlies the resting sleep that one is getting, but there's still a kind of awareness there. There's also, the Buddha himself, one of the things that the Buddha encourages is that one sleeping mindfully on one's right side. And so that one's has a laying down to sleep on one's right side, one's in a position, having one's legs in a position, rather than sort of curling up, that there's a mindful laying down that sets a tone as you fall asleep. One of the things I used to do, I spent made a resolution during a one rains retreat, and so 3 months of the retreat, and I'd have a couple glasses of water, so I'd have my wall. And in Thailand, when you're sleeping on the floor, very very simple mat on the floor, and then there's the wall of the kuti, of the dwelling place, and I place these glasses of water, sort of lying down like this, so that I had about maybe that much space to a few inches, so that I could move a little bit. But if I wasn't really careful, I put one at my knees and one at my trunk of my body, and then lying on my right side, and then to go to sleep, and set that mindfulness, and you knew in the morning when you weren't mindful during the night. either you've got a puddle on the floor, or it's on you, but it really helped me to really cultivate that mindfulness even while sleeping, and that there's a and so that there's an ability to, even you're sleeping, you can move, because it's hard to lie down. Even lying down, your body feels uncomfortable, and there's always some adjustments going on. So that, but that mindfulness, even though one's sleeping, one's still, very aware of that intention to move, and then so that you can cultivate that level of awareness, and. That has that goes into one's daily life. The daily life comes back into that. The meditation, there's a real continuity, through the day and through the night. This continuity of awareness, and the mind becomes very, very bright. Dear Ajahn Pasano, I really enjoyed the talk this morning on understanding dukkha, abandoning the cause, realizing the cessation, and developing the path. In the Dhammacakka Sutta, it talks about the three phases and the 12 aspects regarding the four truths. What are they? Does this tie in with what you talked about this morning? Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. That's what it is. So it's like knowing. There is suffering. There is the duty of knowing it. Then there's I have known that. That's sort of that. There is this thing that needs to be done in terms of understanding suffering. Then there's also that has been understood. So in the same way, there's the truth of the cause of suffering, there's the relinquishing of it, and then there's the that has been relinquished. So that constitutes the sort of these three phases, and the in conjunction with all four truths, or the 12 aspects. Okay, last one. I could use some practical tips from the Buddhist perspective on decision-making. When faced with a decision, I tend to get overwhelmed and freeze up. This can be with big life decisions and even just what meditation object to use. I feel like I have so many choices. This feels like a blessing and a curse. Sometimes it's more on the curse side of things. especially in America, sort of this kind of obsession with having as many options as possible. It doesn't actually make life all that comfortable. With the that sort of around the decision-making process, a lot of or what I've used that I found helpful is paying attention to the tendency to like wavering, that tendency to waver, and that the because then the mind gets swept up in that kind of wavering. And again, I kind of have used the body as the anchor, because one feels that wavering, one feels the indecision, one feels even just you go to reach out for something and it sort of shouldn't be this or that, and it sort of paralyzes the mind. So then just that coming back into the body, just, well, that's indecision, that's wavering, that's uncertainty, that's doubt, and identifying it more and more clearly. And as that's identified, then the suffering in that becomes more apparent, because the assumption is, if I make the right choice, then I'll be free from suffering, I'll be happy. But that's not actually how it works. It's the freeing oneself from suffering that'll help to make the right choice. So it's the other way around. That learning how to sort of relax and not get swept up by the uncertainty, the wavering, the way the mind starts to try to weigh everything or figure it out. And a lot of it, you have to be willing to make mistakes. And they say, well, that was actually a bad choice. That was a bad choice. And you sort of plowing that back into the kind of wisdom and discernment that forms a part of the... because sometimes we can be extraordinarily confident about making a choice or a decision, and it's completely wrong. And other times we can agonize over things that, like sometimes, people will come to me with really need some help in making this decision, and I want to do this practice or that practice, or I want to do this to do this, go there to do this good thing, or go over there to do this good thing. And I said, well, why make a problem out of, it doesn't matter what it is, it's good. So just go ahead and do something. Mm-hmm. And that you're realizing, because sometimes we think that, we set it up if there must be one good one and one bad one, and you should realize, it doesn't have to be that way. These are, one's making a choice between two good things or useful things, beneficial things. So just climb over the hump of wavering indecision and just go ahead and feel good about it. Yeah? So, yeah, don't second guess yourself. Don't torture yourself. Okay, we'll have a short break and come back for the puja.